shopping for food ain't what it used to be, and perhaps we should be glad. Today's guest on Farm to Table Talk has a point of view on that. He's Phil Limpert, also known as a supermarket guru, perhaps the first honest-to-goodness guru that we've had on our podcast. Phil, first of all, we've got to deal with this guru thing. How do you come to be a guru?
Well, Roger, thanks for having me on the show. And the answer is relatively simple. Number one, my grandfather was a dairy farmer. My father was a food manufacturer, so I grew up in the business. But actually, the moniker was given to me by Peter Jennings the first time I appeared on World News Tonight many years ago. That's what he called me. As I left the studio, I called our attorney and I said, do you think we could trademark this? And we have for many years, and that's the story of how Supermarket Guru was born.
How is it changing?
Well, in our grandparents' day, they went to the corner grocer who knew everything that they wanted and gave it to them. Then for our parents, you know, the supermarket, if you would, became the mainstay. And what we've seen over the past probably 40 years is the evolution of supermarkets and the evolution of how we shop. So, again, in our parents' day, they might go shopping once a week to the same store year after year. But with the baby boom generation, everything changed. We wanted to buy different foods at different places. We went shopping 6 times a month to different outlets. In fact, according to IRI, we visit 9 different food-based outlets per month, and that could be everything from a convenience store to a supermarket to buying online and the like. So the atmosphere has changed dramatically, and I think what's leading it, which is so great, is both the baby boomer, Generation X, and certainly the millennial generation have this passion for food. They not only want the great-tasting food, also having it at a good value, but also much more concerned about health and wellness, much more concerned about the traceability of the foods, and much more concerned about the company itself that is actually creating the foods. So it's a one of a time in the food world. It's very exciting, and frankly, for a lot of supermarket retailers, they're just trying to figure it out because they've got more competition than ever before. They've got Aldi on one side with a bare-bones store that has 90% store brands, and then you see some of the super Krogers being built at about 100,000 square foot or more, offering just about every service that we could imagine. And that traditional grocer who's right in between that 40, 45,000 square foot store that we grew up with, frankly, has got to evolve, change, or die.
Well, what about some of, and there's smaller ones too now. There's some small formats too that I keep hearing about.
There are Aldi, Lidl,
oh, okay.
Meyerly Lund's Kitchen, Kroger has a smaller format. Everybody has a smaller format because what we're finding is people like to shop in a small store that's 10 to 15,000 square foot. Obviously, it has a more limited assortment, but frankly, in most cases, it satisfies what everybody needs, and it's not a store that you've got to walk miles and miles in. The average shopper spends only about 22 minutes on a shopping trip. That's whether it's in a big store or a small store. So frankly, if you're in a small store, you're going to be able to read labels more. You're going to be able to read the nutritional, healthful aspects of foods more. And it's just going to be a much more exciting, stimulating shopping experience.
What about the other side, the really big ones? I mean, the Costco's and the Sam's Clubs and that sort of thing. How are they? Are they evolving? Or are they pretty much set in the way they run their programs and are successful?
They're pretty set in the ways that they operate. However, I really want to point out what a great job Costco does in food, and Sam's does a good job too. But Costco, you know, between their sampling program, which happens 7 days a week, as long as the store is open, between high quality foods, Costco actually does more inspections for E. coli than the federal government does across the whole country. Costco is one of the best places to get the highest quality food. But again, you know, you have to be smart when you're buying there because it is larger quantities. And 40% of our foods in this country actually are wasted every year, which is a problem for us. So when you go to a Costco or a Sam's Club, you want to have that shopping list. You want to make sure that you're buying the right quantity, not just buying things because it might appear to be less expensive, that you're going to wind up throwing away. I can go to Costco and have a party for 25 people and do a great job, but if I'm just shopping, you know, for myself, Costco's probably not the right place to go.
Well, best place to get paper towels and toilet paper.
Absolutely.
and also having those little bites on toothpicks.
Exactly.
When they're sampling everything at Costco. What about the other end of the spectrum, the really small, like the convenience stores and the, you know, the places attached to gas stations that are adding more food than what they've had before?
They are adding more food, you're right, and they're adding some terrific food. If you look at Sheetz, for example, in the greater Pennsylvania area, Sheetz is this terrific convenience store gas combination that offers, you know, sit-down gourmet food. Same thing with Quick Trip in Atlanta. And we're really seeing the evolution of so many of these that want to be all food. It's not just going in for, you know, picking up some beef jerky and some cigarettes anymore. There's a lot more offerings. They're making a lot more high quality food, sushi. They're selling produce. They're selling everything that you would want in that old corner store. But the format now is very different. It's attached to a gas station. You're right. It is a sit down meal location. Not just for kids after school, but I know people that go to Sheetz for dinner, because their offerings are so terrific.
Well, you know, there's still an awful lot of them, though, that seems like when I'm out on the road, and I get on the road quite a bit, and so I pull off and I want to get a healthy snack, and still, many of them don't have much that's healthy. I mean, I look through the whole place and I think, well, there's something in here that I can get that I consider healthy, and usually it's like a package of nuts. They are starting to have an apple and a banana, but even iced tea is sweetened usually. And do you think that's going to continue to change? Are they going to continue to try to upgrade and have more than just, you know, kind of the salty, sugary, and fat snacks that have typically been in those gas station type stores?
Yes, absolutely. And the reason is that the numbers are proving to them that it's a business decision. That yes, you've got a small minority of people who still eat that way, if you would. But when you look at truck drivers, you look at anybody who's on the road, they are very concerned about their health and wellness. So even at the truck stops, we're seeing much more healthier offerings. It takes a while because when we take a look, you know, just for example, 7-Eleven themselves, you know, with their tens of thousands of restaurants, it takes a while to really become pervasive throughout all convenience stores in every city in the country. But it's certainly happening at the various trade shows that are geared for convenience stores. We're seeing healthier offerings than ever before. And I think it's a trend that will continue as long as people keep this momentum going that says what we eat does relate to our health and wellness. And it's so critical that we think about what we're eating, because nobody wakes up in the morning and says, hey, you know, I want to die a miserable death. I want to have diabetes and cancer and heart disease. We finally have made this connection with the kind of foods that we eat and how well we're going to live our lives. So definitely think it'll continue and become pervasive.
Like healthy foods too. Is there any change, do you think, in the ratio of how much we're eating out or getting, you know, going to go at fast food restaurants and so forth versus what you're buying at retail?
Well, what we are seeing is still about 50-50. We do anticipate this year seeing an increase in food away from home. And one of the reasons for that has to do actually with beef. This year, what we're seeing is we're seeing much more feedlots. We're seeing about 4% more cattle. We're also seeing heavier cows than prior years. So So it is predicted that the price of beef, which is really a major influencer for fast food and quick serve restaurants, the price of beef is expected to actually decline 10 to 17% this year. So if that happens, there's little doubt that we're going to go back to eating more fast food. But if you take a look at McDonald's, you take a look at Taco Bell, and what they're doing with all their offerings to make them healthier. Taco Bell in particular has done a brilliant job having all vegan dishes, more lower fat dishes. They've reduced their sodium by 15% across the board. And now with the new McDonald's menu, they're improving greatly. It was for fast food for so many years. Oh, we want to have health. So we're going to put out a salad. And, you know, that solves the problem. Well, that didn't solve the problem. And it didn't get people to go to a lot of the fast food restaurants. Now they're finally understanding that people might want vegetarian burgers, that they might want whole grain buns, that they don't want ketchup that's loaded with sugar. So they are slowly changing their offerings as well. And it's, again, you know, fast food, it's been declining. McDonald's has turned that around. Taco Bell has turned it around. Pizza Hut is now making some changes to their formulas as well. And I think that in a very short period of time, 2 to 3 years, you're going to be able to walk in just about any fast food place in the country and have good, substantial, healthier offerings and not have to search for that one lone menu item.
Well, you know, that reminds me that, you know, McDonald's, you mentioned McDonald's, they've started having breakfast all day long, which I think is going to mean a lot more eggs consumed. But if it's not McDonald's, it's some of the other chains who are talking about trying to make sure they're shifting their eggs to free-range eggs. And that's a lot of eggs that would have to go from current conventional systems into eggs from free-range chickens or cage-free or some other description of the chickens. Do you see that as a trend?
Absolutely. Consumers are demanding it, although consumers have no idea what it means. So let me start there. While we did see that shift from McDonald's and others to all-day breakfast, keep in mind that egg prices, because of bird flu, went through the roof. They are coming down now as the flocks are being replaced, but there was just a small outbreak of bird flu in January, which did affect a little bit, but I think we will see the prices come down. When it comes to cage-free, the problem is that people have this picture, consumers have this picture, that what cage-free means is that there's happy-go-lucky chickens, you know, frolicking around. That's not true. What cage-free means is that the birds have access to the outside. Typically, birds do not flock to the outside, but if there's a hole in the side of a barn, and they're all in the barn and they do have access to it, it can be called cage-free. So it's really important for us to understand a lot of this terminology. But you're right, everybody's going cage-free. The Humane Society has worked very hard to make this happen, which I give them kudos for. It should not raise prices. It does not give us a sustainability problem. It's the right thing to do, because a lot of birds for many, many years, you know, were in individual cages where they really even couldn't stand up and you know, stretch their legs or walk around. This is one step better, or multiple steps better than that processing. And, who knows? Maybe one day, you know, it'll even get better and better, and all of our chickens and all of our cows will be grass fed and out in the fields.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was talking to somebody on this program that was saying that even though, say, free range means that they are in a building but they can go outside, but he was pointing out that if you're in the Central Valley of California where it gets to 115 degrees in the summer, those chickens don't want to go outside. Or if you are in, you know, in the middle of Iowa or Illinois in January and it's 25 below zero, those chickens don't want to go outside too. So it's complicated. How do you get, you know, is this kind of a general across the board desire by consumers to know more and understand more about what can be fairly complicated, how their food is grown. Do you see it happening, across the board? Is it just millennials, or is it boomers and millennials? How do you view this desire to tell me more about how my animals, or how the livestock raised, or how the food is produced?
It is across the board. Everyone wants to know more. Everybody wants more transparent practices. Certainly the millennials, being much more astute on their smartphones, can find the information more quickly, but just about every generation is looking for this. And what they're also finding is those companies that are not telling the whole truth, well, they're going to stop buying the products of those companies. So it's really a lot of pressure on the companies to look at everything from the supply chain down to the time that it hits the supermarket shelf to make sure that their products are as open, honest, sustainable, humane, when animal production is involved, as possible. And it's, I believe, something that is really going to change the food world forever.
You know, it's one of those things. It's hard to point your finger at some hard data that said that, 15% insist on it. Or, in so many ways in the supermarket business, there is hard data that they can go to. Here, I still get this sense of it, that there's just a general acceptance that this is important and we're moving this direction. But is there data to support the number of consumers that really want to know that much about how their food is grown?
There is. Probably the most substantial data that we have is about the millennial generation, because that's where the food world is focused. And recent surveys show that between a third and 40% of millennials are looking for transparency, sustainability, and even the labor practices of companies when they decide what food brands to buy. Now, I'm not talking about health claims. I'm not talking about GMO. I'm not talking about, low fat. I'm just talking about the practices of producing our foods. So the number that we do know is between a third and 40% of all millennials are making their decisions on food brands based on that.
Well, and millennials aren't the whole market, but they're the growing market, and they're the future market, and everybody's got their eyes on the millennials. So does this mean, Phil, that in all these places where food is sold, are all of them looking at ways they can incorporate the stories into the way they're marketing it, whether it's, whether it's McDonald's that someday may say that, it's free-range eggs, or, Kroger's putting more information up about almost every product in the store if they can get it? Is it happening everywhere?
Yes, it is. And just about every company, including McDonald's, has made a commitment, and it's over time, to having cage-free eggs. Every supermarket is looking to add more transparency to every individual product that might be on the shelves, as well as their fresh product, as well as the prepared foods, as well as the produce, where it's coming from. Now, the one drawback that we've had out of Washington has been the repeal of country of origin labeling, which I think has been a big mistake, because many consumers really relied on country of origin labeling to determine where seafood was coming from or where meat was coming from. One of the questions that we typically get, and I'm talking about thousands of these per year, is people would pick up ground beef in a supermarket and see on the label product of USA, Mexico, and Canada. And they would send us emails saying, well, what does this mean? Are they taking cows from three different countries and, grinding them together? And the truth is that it's not, that it's less expensive to birth the cow in the U.S., ship it to Mexico to be raised and grown, and then up to Canada to be slaughtered and packaged. And when people find that out, they just say, what? That's as complicated as our food supply is. And yes, and that's one of the reasons that we have this movement for simpler food supply, because when you see all those different touch points across three countries that I described, the risk of food safety problems increases. So I also think we're going to see a movement back to much more simpler food production, as we're seeing major companies and even the cereal companies getting away from artificial colors and artificial flavors, we're really on the brink of a very exciting and very delicious time ahead in food.
Well, do you think that consumers are suspicious of food that's not produced in the United States? I mean, if they say, for example, this is organic from China versus organic from Denmark or organic from California, is there a feeling that among consumers that they can't trust some countries?
Absolutely. You know, and there's apps that are out there like Seafood Watch, which can give you, when you're right in the store, the top line of what seafood is sustainable, what claims, what seafood is coming from dirty water and the like. I guarantee that when you buy a product that has the USDA organic certification seal on it, that's what it is. From other countries, not so much. So, you know, it's important. There are countries around the world. You mentioned Denmark, Holland, Ireland, other parts of Europe that have just as high, if not higher, quality and food safety standards that we do in the U.S., not so much in Asia. South America does have some countries like Chile and Peru that are doing a great job. And again, their standards are terrific. But other countries may not be as high. So if you've got any questions you really want to ask the people in your supermarket, whether it's behind the meat case, whether it's the produce department, about the safety of these products, about what these label claims are. I can say 100% that we've got the safest food supply in the world. We do our best to protect that. And, you know, I personally prefer, you know, produced in USA products, just for myself and my family.
Well, I'm the same as you, because I've visited some other countries that that I really wouldn't want to, after I've gone through their plants, I don't think I would necessarily want to be buying food regularly from there. And in those countries, they prefer to get food from the United States and rather local because they believe that they can depend on the United States. Which brings up one other potentially political point, I guess, and that is that these trade talks that are going on right now, and some of the people that are opposed or fearing the trade agreements are afraid to get into something like the country of origin labeling being reversed from the WTO, and that it's just one more thing that raises doubts and suspicions in the minds of consumers. I don't know if we can solve trade talks right now, but do you see a connection to that as well?
Well, I think when we look at trade talks, the most important area of it has to do with farming. And we've got to remember that we've had two major problems here in California. One has been the drought. The other one has been immigration labor. And if we're going to continue to farm on the ground and in fields and do agriculture the way we've been doing it for centuries, we need labor. And it's fine to talk about whether it's building walls or trade agreements or whatever. But the past couple years, there have been a lot of good crops that have been left on the ground in California, in Florida, in Texas, and in Arizona because we haven't had laborers to pick this food. So we've got to be smart about it and either make it more mechanical so we don't need labor or have these laborers be able to come into the country and help feed the world. And it's a very complicated situation, and most consumers forget that, you know, all of our food comes from the ground, and that's where it starts and ends there. And if we don't have that resource, we're really going to have to think twice about the way we feed our planet. And, you know, maybe we go back to the days of you know, Edward G. Robinson and Soylent Green, where we're all taking a green pill for breakfast, a red pill for lunch, and a brown pill for dinner.
Well, you know, this need for information, Phil, to me, it's just what a huge job this is going to be. If consumers want to know where their food is grown and how it's grown and something about the type, about everything, how are we going to get all this information out to explain how the cattle are produced with antibiotics or without, and how the, you know, whether it's grass-fed or not, whether it's organic or not. There's almost only so much space on a label or so much space available in a menu to be able to add explanation and stories. How are we going to give the millennials and the others all the information they're looking for?
Yeah, we're going to have to use the internet. And I'm not sure that the label scheme that's discussed now with the QR code is the answer. And again, you know, there's been a lot of controversy saying a lot of people in the country don't have smartphones. And what about them? But clearly the internet is a major resource for us. What we've got to do is we've got to have checks and balances with this resource to make sure that the information is accurate and it's true. And frankly, a lot of it's going to fall on the companies and third-party certification programs to make sure that what's being posted on websites and on packaging is legal, it's true, it's clear. And, you know, the time has come for that. And I believe that companies who might have 20 or 25 years ago tried to do the marketing language to get around certain truths are not doing that anymore. They realize we're much more educated when it comes to food society. People will find out the truth, whether or not you want them to or not. We've got a bunch of people out there, ourselves included, trying to make sure that the information is accurate and true. And it's great. And I think the more people that do get interested in our food, again, from farm to fork, not just on the supermarket shelves, helps our industry.
Well, you know what? That's a great final word. I appreciate your wrapping that up, and it feels like you've got some optimism going forward, that the right things are happening for the right reasons.
Absolutely. I think the industry, retailers, consumers are all coalescing around food, and we all have the same objective. You know, we don't need, and I say this respectfully, you know, we don't need another 10, you know, colored M&Ms. And even M&M Mars recognize that when you look at a lot of the new snacks and confections that they're coming out with, they're healthier. They're using real sugar. They're not having artificial colors and flavors. So it's a ground sweeping movement in the food world, and very proud to be part of it.
Well, Phil, we're proud of the job you're doing to spread the word and explain what's happening. Thank you, and thank you for being with us this morning in our conversation on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you.